Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, University of Richmond, the Spiders dealt Iowa some equality yesterday.
Yeah, they sure did. But I called that. I knew that that was going to happen. Because every time Iowa wins the Big Ten championship, which is not a lot, they tank the first round.
Did you pick Richmond?
I think I picked Richmond. I know I did not have Iowa advancing anywhere past, I think I had maybe Iowa playing South Dakota State, and that was it, and then being beat by the Jackrabbits.
Yeah,
well, I watched the Jackrabbits game because my nephew goes there, and I love Christy. No, I'm the governor there, and they didn't do well. I was expecting better.
It's interesting. It's, I guess, picking teams based on who the governor of the state in which the school is located is better than doing it based on uniforms.
Yeah, it is. It's better than color. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I did like the Jackrabbit blue and yellow. It's very stunning.
Don't bet against Catholic schools on St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, St. Peter's. That was the best game I've seen all year. Wasn't that awesome? Did you pick that one, Dan?
Yeah.
Because I noticed you're number two here.
It was
company pool.
No, I didn't pick St. Peter's, but I didn't have Kentucky going very far. So no death blows for me in the first day. It's nice to see St. Peter's, a Jesuit university, see the players for St. Peter's wearing Black Lives Matter warm-ups on the bench. That was nice. It's wonderful. Another wonderful Catholic university. Oh, the Jesuits have done it again over at St. Peter's. Yeah. What about the other, you know, I think it's a relatively minor upset, but New Mexico State beating Connecticut. And here's where we get past chalk talk into something perhaps more interesting for more of our listeners. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if people are boycotting the NCAA by boycotting March Madness the way you are the NFL or some of these other hyper-politicized professional sports leagues, because the NCAA is hyper-politicized, but it doesn't mean that basketball itself is so much. Although, again, I'm making the argument the other way, too, when I'm mentioning equality on the uniforms of Iowa and Black Lives Matter warm-ups for St. Peter's. So, you know, I could see it either way.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
But, you know, Teddy Buckets, I don't know if you watched the game. Teddy Allen is an outstanding player for New Mexico State. I think he had 37 yesterday.
Oh, my gosh.
And I think he also scored the final 15 for the Aggies there. Yeah, New Mexico State Aggies.
Yeah, right, in Las Cruces.
New Mexico.
New Mexico what?
What's the nickname for New Mexico?
The
University of New Mexico.
University of Mexico.
Think Bamba Bamba.
Paralata La Bamba.
Think Bamba Bamba.
I don't know. I lived in El Paso. I went to Las Cruces.
Who sang the Ricky Valens song? Who sang the song about Ricky Valens? It wasn't Ricky Valens. Ricky Valens.
No. And Buddy Holly died with him in that plane crash.
Yeah, right. Big Bopper. Yeah, we
Big
got
Bopper.
That.
Mike?
Mike will know it, so Mike give you a hint.
No, you don't know it.
He does know it.
No, he's looking it up right now.
He does know it. Let's go. What? I already gave New Mexico State the Aggies.
Well, yeah, they're the Aggies.
New Mexico.
In Las Cruces, yes.
And New Mexico is what?
Oh, wait, hold on.
I've given you the
University of New Mexico.
Obvious hint. I mean, I can't give you a better hint than that.
No, they're in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
I know the high school.
I don't need the student enrollment. I don't need feeder schools. I just need the nickname.
You don't need feeders. No.
University of New Mexico. State College.
I don't know.
The Lobos.
Oh, the Lobos. You just said bomb, 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 bomb.
Who sang it? I mean, come on.
Well,
you're better than that. Sad.
Well, you don't know it's sad.
Age. It's age.
No. I'm still grieving the Hawkeyes loss.
Yeah.
Do you have any final words for Hawkeye fans out there that obviously are probably hurting? Not as much as you, but
hurting.
Listen to this. This is
great. Knowing this is a tough day.
just thanks for giving me a chance. You know, this has been...
He's a senior.
Some of the best years of my life. I can't even put into words what...
Random Iowa Hawkeye player Keaton. From Amy. It's just
coach is meant to
wonderful.
Me. Hold on, I didn't know his name.
Yeah, he's okay. Was it Fran McCaffrey's kid?
No, it's Joseph. No, he's got two kids on the team. The three-point shooter, Bohannon. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
See, I was getting there.
Yeah, boy.
I know that there's two brothers. The coach is two sons.
Yeah.
And then there's two Murray brothers on the team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
now I know that they're out.
Iowa Hawkeyes beat
So they can take their quality jerseys and...
Yeah. You know, so can I get back to Teddy Buckets now?
Yeah, who's Teddy Buckets from Los Bobos? Bah, 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 bah.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to look up this
He
kid.
Had...
Eddie Buckets?
Teddy Buckets. Yeah, Teddy Allen.
Thank you.
So he has attended almost as many schools as he made free throws yesterday. He's had run-ins with the law, arrested criminal damage to property. I think he's got a domestic as well.
Oh, no.
He was so much of... he was so rough. Even Bob Huggins at West Virginia had enough, which is that's interesting. In his New Mexico State University athletics, the write up on him, had a little difficulty in making a highly productive return to NCAA in his lone season at Lincoln, one of the places.
He's in Nebraska.
He
too?
Was. He's been at five schools.
Okay. Is he a ninth year senior here? Well, because of COVID now, they stayed. Everybody was redshirted. So that's why it's been harder to recruit people last year to go to colleges.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's a 6 year senior. Thanks.
Yeah, you're completely missing the point, but that's interesting.
No, I want to hear
that. He's not struggling academically. He's struggling with staying on the right side of the law, and he's bouncing around from university to university, and they're picking him up because he's a great basketball player.
And he's added everywhere.
Started Boys Town High School for two seasons.
Okay.
Started Boys Town. calling Father Flanagan. And went from there. So it's just sort of an interesting thing because he's had some run-ins with the law. You had a former Iowa standout, Sam Mack, who had some run-ins with the law. And he had to bounce around to schools. He had a really good NBA career. I think he was in the NBA for almost a decade. But it's just one of these things because we talk about this in the context of... street crime in Chicago, like, for example, this from CWB Chicago. Prolific locker room burglar did it again. Just weeks after being paroled for 10 felonies, he's back robbing fitness center locker rooms. And so it's sort of the how many chances
do you get?
And we talk about it in the context of people who are not standout athletes and these habitual criminals, and in often cases, habitual violent criminals. And I think when you start to get violence, your chances run out much more quickly. But with athletes, if you're a standout athlete, then you get a lot of chances. I mean, think since Nebraska was mentioned, it can go well. Maybe it'll go well for Teddy Buckets this time. Maybe. It can go horribly since Nebraska was mentioned, Lawrence Phillips. Oh. How many chances did Lawrence Phillips get? And he winds up being a habitual criminal and killing himself in prison. I mean... I thought people don't pay attention to the story because it's not the one moment in time story that everybody wants to focus on when it comes to March Madness, but just because he is such a good player, he had such a good game yesterday in the upset over UConn, and he's had such a spotty run from high school to the collegiate level. I don't know. I just kind of interested. You think about second chances, and we're a second chance country, third, fourth, fifth chance country in some cases.
We're an eighth, ninth chance county in Cook County.
But who gets second, third, and fourth chances, and who doesn't, and what the metric should be? I don't know. Just I sort of waxing philosophic about it when I was watching Teddy Buckets poured in yesterday. So just a little food for thought.
Yeah, and let's talk. Titles here. How many? You're in second place here. Mike Scott is in first place for our office pool. For the, what did you just press? Autofill.
Playing games don't count.
No, they don't. So that's why you're still alive and on the top.
by a.
Yeah. We did Quinn McCarthy lonely at the bottom.
Yeah.
No. I have Arizona winning it all.
Yeah. Well, neither you nor Arizona will be winning it all.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and this installment of Sports and Politics. We turn our attention to college sports, not March Madness, but Marxist madness in college sports. Leah Thomas. It becomes the first man to win a women's national championship yesterday at the national championship meet. Here's what Leah Thomas had to say to ESPN upon his victory.
Leah, how did that performance measure up to your expectations coming into this meet tonight?
I didn't have a whole lot of expectations for this meet. I was just happy to be here trying to race and compete as best as I could.
You've undoubtedly been under the spotlight over the past few months. How have you been dealing with that and reasoning with everything?
I try to ignore it as much as I can. I try to focus on my swimming, what I need to do to get ready for my races, and just try to block out everything else.
What did that race mean to you?
It means the world to be here, be with two of my best friends and teammates, and be able to compete.
Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you so much.
He seems like a nice guy. Martina Navratilova said Leah Thomas's wins should have an asterisk next to them. Mm-hmm. She continues to oppose men participating in women's sports for all sorts of obvious reasons. But what about that, the decision has been made to let him swim, even though he's been a little full of himself, calling himself the Jackie Robinson of trans.
Please.
And so forth. A little ridiculous, but he's a nice guy. He's confused about his gender. So just let it go. Just let it go and let's move on. Right?
Give in to his delusion and let this happen.
Well, it did happen. It's happened. It's past tense. So let's just move on. Right.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. There were people in the stands. One woman had a banner that said, "Save women's sports." You have Emma Wyant. She's a University of Virginia swimmer who placed second in the 500 freestyle behind Leah Thomas. So second is the new first now, right? I mean, she's an actual biological female. But Thomas beat her by almost 2 seconds.
Is she the Olympic medalist that he beat?
I know he participated in the 500 freestyle and the 200 freestyle.
But
he won the 500 freestyle. I watched that race, and it was not even close.
I saw something on social media about it, one of the women that he beat was an Olympic medalist.
Yeah, because he's going to be going to the Olympics. He is going to be competing in the women's Olympics. If we don't stop this now, that is what is going to happen. And how do we know that? Because New Zealand had a female transgender competing in the weightlifting competition, and they let that happen. So why wouldn't they let Leah Thomas participate?
I don't know. I mean, it's so hard to have sympathy for these Title IX ideologues.
How could these women let this happen? We fought so hard for women's sports.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying we, but I'm saying the women before me fought for us to have a female basketball team.
I don't know.
Female volleyball team. Anything female.
There's a bit of Title IX comeuppance here, isn't there? Isn't there? Or am I being too difficult on the topic? We're all supposed to run and celebrate and cherish women's sports in an unqualified way, despite the fact that Title IX was really sort of a ham-handed way to expand women's sports. And it turned collegiate sports into a bit of a zero-sum game. And I mean, and men are disposable generally, particularly white men. So sports that are predominantly played by white men are the first casualties, right? I mean, that's if they're non-revenue. Isn't that right? Is that what's happened over the last 40 years, or do I have it wrong?
God, you should see the picture of them on the winner's stand. You've got Leah Thomas here, and then the person that was in, the women that were second, third, and fourth were huddled together, and Leah Thomas is way off to the right. I just think that summed up everything very well. I'll tweet it out.
A Virginia Tech swimmer apparently didn't take Leah Thomas's participation at the national championship too well. A friend of this Virginia Tech swimmer's, this Virginia Tech female swimmer, spoke with a reporter about her friend not making the final 16 because, well, because there was a dude in the final 16.
You're a Virginia Tech swimmer. What did you think about Leah Thomas competing today as a swimmer in this competition? What are you feeling? What are other athletes feeling?
It's a common conception that we are all very disappointed and frustrated with someone who has capabilities more than us women have to be able to compete at this level and take opportunities away from other women. Like, I have a teammate who did not make finals today because she was just bumped out of finals. And it's heartbreaking to see someone who went through puberty as a male and has the body of a male be able to absolutely blow away the competition. And you go into it with a mindset that you don't have a chance, if that makes sense. Like, it's hard to compete against someone with the aerobic capacity, the muscle development, the body of a man. It's hard. It's hard to think about it like that. And staying positive, I bet, for other swimmers who are in that heat is probably overwhelming. I'm not sure. I can't speak for them, but it's disappointing to see and frustrating, definitely.
And you said that one of your teammates was crying today because she didn't make the finals. You said that she was 17th,
yes,
and there were 16 spots.
Yes.
So Leah Thomas took one of those spots. Yes. Talk to us about what your teammate was going through and that experience.
She was very emotional, and it's hard to see because it's her last NCAAs, and she really loves that race, and it was just heartbreaking to see that she put all her effort into it today and went the best time that she went in a morning session before and still not make it back. It's hard to see someone who works every day, every night, still not be able to compete against someone like that.
Full right. Hearts, clear eyes, can't lose. Big hearts, full, clear eyes, can't lose. The point that she makes, she's making, you know, men have bigger hearts, more oxygen gets to the muscles.
Yeah. I mean, even the stretch, like when he was swimming, he had more stamina. And his stroke was long. He looked like Michael Phelps out there. And by the way, Emma Wyant, who really won, who came in second, she is an Olympic silver medalist.
I thought so. Yeah, I
from the
that.
Tokyo Games. And she, if they don't stop this, Leah Thomas is going to be competing in the women's swimming competition at the 2024 Olympics in Paris, France.
Well, I mean, again, it's done. So let's just
move
on.
He has a penis. That is wrong.
No, I got it. Boys have a penis and girls have a vagina. I saw Kindergarten Cop.
Okay.
So, yeah, I know that.
I'm just saying I mean, if you're going to be committed to the cause, chop it off, buddy. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be so blunt, but it's true.
Well, you can just tuck it.
Well, that's what he's been doing. He's been tucking it in between the legs.
Yeah. They're the Dornbecker Children's Hospital in Portland.
Yeah.
I think it's Portland. They're teaching little boys to tuck as part of, part of how they cope with their gender dysphoria, although that's not how they're describing it. Girls are being taught how to bind their breasts in order to pass as male. They have slides for the parents and for the kids at the Dornberger Children's Hospital about how boys can tuck and girls can bind so that they can present as the opposite sex.
Don't affirm what you know are lies, says Matt Walsh.
Larry and Elmhurst, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. Hey, you think Leah will ever get married and have kids? And if so, how many?
He could get married there. Easily. I mean, thanks. He still has his package. Children.
Brian in St. John, Indiana.
So my 5-year-old daughter knows there's two genders and there's boys and girls. And I told her, stand up and be proud of that fact if anyone ever confronts her in opposition. But nonetheless, the NCAA tournament is my favorite sports weekend of the year. Historically, I'll watch, 12 hours a day for four days straight. I won't be, you know, I'll watch a little bit here and there this weekend, but I won't be watching like I've used to. But my main question is, I wonder if Buick is going to put out a press release opposing Will Thomas, because, you know, they got these See Her Greatness commercials all over the tournament. So that's all I got. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's they right, do. Those... Yeah. Thanks for the call, Brian. Well, I mean,
and that's Buick that's it. I can't remember who's.
Mike in Plano.
Hey, Dan, you know, you mentioned the other day how the sports media goes out of their way to push left-wing agendas just to go along, to get along. Well, even though these two agendas are often in conflict with one another, they go out of their way to not only push LGBT, but extreme feminism. Everything today is now, we need more female athletes, more female coaches, more female broadcasters. And the thing is, I was listening the other day to a couple local Chicago guys who are, of course, liberal. But they're talking about the Deshaun Watson situation, how he was criminally cleared. And they're still saying how he should be blackballed. And one of the hosts says, what would the Me Too movement think if he came back in the league? I'm like, first of all, I thought the Me Too movement died 4 or 5 years ago. But second of all, who is the Me Too movement? It's a bunch of angry, aging liberal women. They're not sports fans. Who cares what they think? Stop pandering to people who don't even follow you in your sports industry.
All right, thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, the identitarians that focus on women, who are some of whom are rallying for these female swimmers that have to compete against Leah Thomas, or Will Thomas, as I think Brian somebody mentioned, had. which is yeah, that's his
was
name.
Was that his name?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because remember, he swam in the men's program for 3 years.
Yeah. How empathetic should we really be to so much of this crowd? I mean, how many of the people now holding the Women's Sports Matter signs at these meets are identitarians who brought so much of this upon themselves? They just didn't think it would be visited on them in this way. Why should I care? Honestly, why should I care about what happens to women's sports? I proposed this long ago. If it's just based on what you feel, and you want full equality and equality as they improperly define it, and women can do anything men can do, then why do we have women's and men's sports? Why do we have best female actor and best male actor? Eliminate all the categories, blur all the lines. See how that works out for you. And then if no women can compete, or very few, against men in these various sports, well, then you just institute quotas. And then nobody will watch. Fine. Why do I care? Why should I care about these moms of Ivy League female swimmers who are now presenting their crocodile tears?
They let this happen.
Here's one.
Oh, really?
When their news started asking questions, the schools in each case across the Ivy League pulled their swimmers aside and said, you're not allowed to talk about this. And they're frightened. They're frightened of losing friends. They're frightened of being kicked off their teams. They're frightened of being told by their universities that they're transphobic and hateful.
Too bad, so sad. Why do I care about scared Ivy League undergrads, female swimmers? Well, honestly, to tell me why I should care, and their parents and their families. Oh, now the mob has come for you, the identitarians that you appeased, if not outright supported. They are negatively impacting your daughter's time at Yale or Penn or wherever. I mean, why I should care why? People realizing the consequences of the positions they take and the things they do and don't do. And now we're supposed to rally for them and for those girls at Penn or in D1 women swimming. Why? Why should I rally for them any more than I should rally for restaurants who were served as sentinels of the state because they want to bail out, because they miscalculated? They thought the state was going to protect them. So they're all in for the COVIDian rally around the flag. And then when it doesn't turn out quite as they were promised or thought, now I'm supposed to pay for it? Why? Leah Thomas can win every female championship, as far as I'm concerned.
She has more races today and Saturday.
Tell me why I should care about the plight of the people that are throwing up their hands all of a sudden. John and Samanak.
Yeah, you know, we've opened up also another major situation here that any good attorney would open up the class action lawsuit. We've not allowed steroids in college sports for 30, 40 years now, but now we're allowing trans men, trans women to compete that are chemically altered to compete. We're introducing hormones. Essentially, that is steroids being allowed.
They're moving to set testosterone levels for qualification, but then there's still manipulation. Thanks for the culture. Right. No, I agree, but identity trumps that concern. They'll work around it as they are at present.
On an ancillary issue, his talk about steroids. They used to check high school, college for steroids. They stopped doing that because then they started checking for COVID, and they forgot about all the other substances that were being abused to build bigger bodies. They should get back to that too.
Amish texture on the tin can and string hotline.
Very special day.
Good morning. You know, I just was thinking on hold that we've gone from teaching kids duck and cover to now tuck and cover in education. That's really sad. But anyways, everybody knew that Leah Thomas was going to win that championship. But it left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouth for one reason, because she was so cocksure. Happy 50th anniversary of Title IX, by the way, Amy.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I'll be looking in my mailbox for your card that you sent me.
Mike and Hammond.
Hey, thanks for my call. Hey, guys, where did we think this whole thing was going to go when Bruce Jenner was named Woman of the Year by ESPN, when you had all the other deserving biological women in line? Bruce Jenner, Woman of the Year. That's it. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, Rachel Levine, the number two at HHS, was one of what, Newsweek's Women of the Year, too?
That wretched person who took her mom out of a nursing home because she knew what was going on. That person, that selfish being, who let the other people die, but I'm going to get my mom out. But Bruce Jenner, in his defense, her defense, whatever, does not like the fact that Leah Thomas is being allowed to compete in women's sports. And she said, I got to get my pronouns right. I'm sorry.
Not much of a defense. And by the way, you're the key word that you just used.
What?
Whatever. And that's right. Whatever.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. There has been a declaration of war.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Congress has declared war in Ukraine. Well, not exactly Congress, but House Democrat Socialist Majority Leader Steny Hoyer did yesterday.
This polarization is hurting our country. This polarization, where we are not thinking about the substance but the politics, is hurting America. And the fact, at a time of war, we're at war. We're not physically on the field with the Ukrainians, but we ought to do everything we possibly can to make sure that they can meet this enemy and defeat this enemy.
Uh-huh. And Senator John Kennedy, now on the other side, a Republican, on Hannity last night.
First, I think it's clear that the leader of the free world is President Zelensky. He and the Ukrainian people are tough as a boot, and we need to have their back.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Are you ready to go to war with Russia if need be? And I'm not suggesting weapons for the Ukrainians and the whole laundry list that was presented the other day by Biden that they're now being supplied with by America is going to war with Russia. But I'm saying the next step, once they decide to stop providing that qualification of not boots on the ground, we're not on the field, and just go to war formally with Russia. Simple question. Are you ready for that? You think that's a good idea?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Does that rhetoric bother you at all? We're at war. Zelensky is the leader of the free world. I mean, I know what Kennedy is trying to say, the weakness of the West, but, and I know Kennedy is given for colloquialisms and hyperbole. I know sarcasm is his stock and trade, and sometimes it's very good. But Zelensky is the leader of the free world. Is this a little over the top for you at all? A little concerning at all? Coming from both sides, this, to my mind, madness of crowds aspect to our discussion about what to do in Ukraine? Does it remind you at all about all of the pro forma statements you needed to make to be considered a legitimate participant in any conversation in COVID? If you disagreed with any aspect of where the majority was, then you were a COVID denier.
Or do you think Zelensky should just surrender or come to some sort of agreement with Russia?
Well,
that would actually maybe be heroic and save lives.
Well, that's a legitimate question. And John Kennedy, you just heard him, give Ukraine whatever it needs to win. Is winning a possibility, realistic possibility?
Or is this just going to initiate World War III by having the U.S. get involved?
Should we take the position that former Obama ambassador to Russia, Mike McFaul, has taken? Whatever Zelensky wants, you give him?
I mean, I admire him. I mean, he's been wearing the army green for 3 weeks straight. He's ready to go. He hasn't left his people. He had an offer to be, you know, taken out of Ukraine, and he's staying and fighting with his people. But do we join his fight?
Yeah, his communications have been very good.
Yeah, yesterday he spoke with the German lawmakers.
Yeah,
it's the same song and dance. Yeah, but that's, you know, he's trying to be effective. He's trying to make progress. He's trying to win.
Uh-huh. Is that the right play? And is backing that the right play for the United States?
Do you want your son and daughters to go, well, mostly your sons, to possibly go to war?
U.S. ambassador to the U.N. During the last 2 years of the Bush administration, Zalmay Khalilzad, the West must risk more for Ukraine now. The West's expectation seems to be that over time, the cost of protracted conflict will exhaust Russia and lead to its withdrawal from Ukraine and possibly to change to a political change in Moscow. U.S. and Western allies have selected a strategy that minimizes risk to themselves by avoiding conflict with Russia. This assumes that Russia is willing to risk a limited air-to-air war with the West, or perhaps even a broader conflict over Ukraine, were the U.S. and NATO to impose a no-fly zone. It further assumes Moscow is willing to risk more over Ukraine than the West is, because Ukraine is more important to Russia than it is to the West. Is that not true? He argues the current U.S. strategy doesn't eliminate risk. It merely pushes the risk of conflict to a later stage in time. And the U.S. should revise its strategy to set the stage for negotiating a palatable solution between Russia and Ukraine. Yeah, okay. That's fine to suggest brokering peace, but the suggestion is that we have to get deeper in order to play the role of peace broker. Is that right? I don't know. I mean, this stuff to me is, it's just a little concerning when you hear the sort of rhetoric across the spectrum that you're hearing. and you have the full-on sentimentality of the left in lieu of a very hard-headed analysis of the risks and opportunities in the context of what our national security interests are with respect to Ukraine. And also, you know, our understanding of what the responsibilities will be depending on the choices we make, how this plays out in the medium term. I mean, for goodness sakes, on the sentimentality front, Nancy Pelosi yesterday, you got her House Democrat Socialist Majority Leader banging the war drum while she's reading Bono poems.
Oh. But in sorrow and fear, that's when saints can appear to drive out those old snakes once again. And they struggle for us to be free from the psycho in this human family. Ireland's sorrow and pain is now the Ukraine. And St. Patrick's name is now Zelensky.
Oh, dear.
Not since Shel Silverstein have I heard such prose.
I cannot go to school today, said little Peggy.
What? Okay. I mean, this is how it's going to go down? We talked a little bit about this yesterday, too. How Ukraine got into this position since it gained independence in 91, where regardless if you had a pro-Western administration like Zelensky or a pro-Putin administration, pro-Russia administration like Yanukovych, it was a playground for the oligarchs. And he's the leader of the free world now. This story from the Telegraph across the pond. British medical volunteers have claimed the Ukrainian army duped them into crossing the border before trying to conscript them as quote-unquote cannon fodder for the Battle of Kyiv. Carl Walsh and Ali Funnell left the UK with the hope of putting their expertise to use treating casualties in the war zone, but were instead told they would be deployed to defend Ukraine's besieged capital. Walsh is 50 years old, number one, former combat medical tech. And the other guy, Funnell, is a paramedic who became a teacher. Mm-hmm. Both men contacted the Ukrainian embassy in the UK offering to help after seeing the appeal by Zelensky for volunteers to join the country's resistance against the Russian invaders. So this is how they could help, their medical expertise. And they feel like they got bait and switched. To join the International Legion, the Ukrainians wanted to take our passports off us, sign a year contract, give us training for 2 days, 48 hours, and then within another 48 hours, we would be fighting in Kyiv. That's not what they had in mind. And again, I take the perspective of trying to call for all hands and all weapons on deck if you're Zelensky or Klitschko in Kyiv and you're trying to repel the Russian invaders. But it's so one-sided. There's not even contemplation of some of the pitfalls, some of the excesses. Are we being led down a primrose path? Are they leading themselves down a primrose path? Taking a step back, soberly looking at the landscape, opportunities, threats, responsibilities that we could bring upon ourselves. It's just the rush to turn speechifying into an entanglement. And I think people should be restrained in consideration of what is being intimated by the political ruling class in this state. I mean, in this country, the lessons of the last 20 years of war, the lessons of the madness of crowds from the last 2 years of COVID, none of that's relevant. Carl in Southern Indiana. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
This boils down to the culture war has been lost. Ukraine's going to fall. The Balkans are going to fall. Poland's going to fall. After China takes Taiwan, we got people, you know, those Eastern Bloc leaders are playing Risk. Joe Biden and the Western leaders are playing Go Fish. History books are going to show that we lost the culture war, fell like the Roman Empire, because we went with the socialist style instead of freedom. And they're going to go, what were you thinking?
Thanks, Carl.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, there's a light on in the attic. Thought the house is dark and shuttered. I can see a flickering flutter, and I know what it's about. There's a light on in the attic. I can see it from the outside, and I know you're on the inside.
Ew.
Looking out. Yeah, I just thought I would offer treacly prose for no particular reason, since Bono is doing it, Nancy Pelosi's celebrating it.
Oh, okay.
In lieu of any sort of serious discussion about Ukraine and Russia and America's national security interests. I just want to
get that out there.
I just want to join the zeitgeist. I just want to be part of the in crowd.
Well, we have a lot of text messages. One said, how funny, the political left is now hawkish for war. And there's no way I'm supporting going to war until the European countries have enough courage themselves to get involved.
Yeah, okay, so the European countries are involved. So if they go to war, the question then becomes, do you want Western European countries to go to war? Do you want them to put boots on the ground in Russia? Because then we're up next, aren't we? So you can't just offload this to Western Europe and say, hey, if they do it, then we do it. No. If whether they do it or don't do it is a different calculation than ours. It's part of the calculation.
And our friends and family in Europe, I mean, they're scared. They're right there. We're you know, an ocean away from all of this, but they're scared if Putin's not stopped now that they're going to take over their countries.
Speaking of Ukraine, you remember Hunter Biden.
Oh, yeah. He was the president of some.
He was on the board of Burisma. Yeah. He got along famously with the oligarchs in Ukraine, regardless of who the presidential administration was, you'll note. New York Times has discovered Hunter Biden has a laptop.
Wait, he does? Wait, can we even talk about that, or are we going to get yanked?
We're not the New York Post, so I don't know if we'll get yanked or not. But Hunter Biden apparently... he like dropped off a laptop at some Delaware repair shop,
and
it's got a bunch of emails on it about his business dealings and
some nefarious photographs.
Yeah.
Of him doing some weird things with a crack pipe.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, it's so disturbing to watch that.
Yeah. How about that?
Oh, so they're finally realizing now that that is a true story?
Yeah, Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson, was asked about it yesterday, and Phil Wegman from Real Clear Politics. Here's what she said.
The New York Times has authenticated emails that appear to have come from a laptop abandoned by Hunter Biden in Delaware. The president previously said that the New York Post story about this was a bunch of garbage and that it was a Russian plant. Does he stand by that assessment?
I've pointed to the Department of Justice and also to Hunter Biden's representatives. He doesn't work in the government.
Shuts her binder. Case closed.
Going to work in the government. Oh, okay.
Well, all right. You know what, Dan? It's an answer.
All right. Well, give our regards to the big guy.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Busted.
Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Art Laffer was on Fox Business yesterday talking about the economy after the Fed's first much anticipated interest rate hike, where things stand. And this is what the Laffer Curve founder had to say.
But when you're looking at this correctly, it's you're right. I don't see a heck of a lot in this economy that makes me happy or optimistic about the future. The producer's price index at 10% is a very high number. And what you have to remember, Sean, is that that number is higher than the consumer price index. And it occurs at an earlier stage. So if you look at the stages of growth in a product going through the process, it means that consumer prices probably will be rising as well to rise up to meet the producer's price index. And, you know, it's not a good outlook there. I don't see any much good outlook in what's happening in Europe. That's not good. In China, the lockdowns, these are all pieces of bad news. At some point, they will change, but I don't think they're going to change anytime soon, Sean.
And you have other investment advisors and commentators on these investotainment shows on Fox Business and CNBC calling on Americans to prepare for a recession this summer, a bear market, real estate, a drop in stock prices, and basically the end of the world.
We're going to die.
So where are we at? What can we anticipate in the near term, meaning like the calendar year? For more on this, pleased to be joined by Jim Urio, analyst for Fox Business. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So what about our friend Art Laffer had to say and some of what you're undoubtedly hearing from other analysts on these investotainment shows about the bad news, the gathering storm, the end of Western civilization?
Well, I definitely have a lot of concern, but those guys are making me look downright rosy at this point in time. And maybe it's the glow of the NCAA tournament and the weather changing, but I think there are some things to be a little bit happy about. I think that when I just anecdotally going around, going to restaurants, things I do, and I hate to even talk about COVID, but I think people are completely over that. And I think there probably is still some pent up demand as far as traveling, things like that goes. What I am, though, very, very concerned. So the Fed tightened yesterday, and for a year, for more than a year, people like me, like Brian Westbury, like Art Laffer, like Larry Kudlow, have been saying, not to put myself in the same group with those guys, but you know what I mean, have been saying the Fed needs to tighten. This is absolutely ridiculous. There's no reason to believe that inflation is transitory, and they didn't, and they kept buying bonds. They kept buying bonds up until last week. Now they're tightening. They tighten yesterday. But the reality of it is people don't realize a couple things. When crude oil rallies to the price that it has, that's already an economic tightening. That's pulling money out of people's pockets and starting to slow down the economy. So now my worry is that the Fed's going to aggressively raise rates right into the teeth of a slowing economy, and they're going to cause a recession. I don't think when we think about recessions, people our age think about the big one, you know, the Great Financial Recession, the recession that happened after the tech collapse in around the turn of the century. I don't think it's anything like that because I don't see these enormous built-up leveraged positions in different assets. I see a lot of built-up leveraged positions, but it's spread pretty broadly. So I don't think it's going to be terrible. But the yield curve, and I don't mean to get too into the woods here, but the yield curve for, I know you guys know it, but for the listeners, is the comparison of long-end rates to short-end rates. And when they get about the same or the long-end rates go below, it's a signal that the market is telling us that financial conditions are too tight, not too loose, not too low of rates, and that there's a recession that's potentially coming. So I'm definitely glum, but not as glum as those guys, if that makes sense.
But you, it seems from what Jay Powell said the other day when announcing that quarter point hike, that the Fed is going to use rate hikes to bring down inflation, and they will continue to hike rates until they see a positive move on inflation.
Yeah, and I think that they're committed to doing that. I hate the psychology behind the Fed, because once they've committed to doing that, their needle isn't pointed to zero anymore. They definitely have it in their head that they missed the boat to tighten. They're supposed to be tightening now. And when the situation changes, of course, I fear that they won't be able to identify that quickly enough. And that's happened a million times in the past. So that's, I think they're probably going to over tighten. And remember, our economy from a broad sense, and this is now I'm taking like a 30,000 foot, you know, 35-year view on this. We need low rates because our economy is overtaxed and overregulated from every different governing body, from Fed, federal government, state government, county government, municipality government. There's too many taxes and regulations, and that's why the country needs the drip of low rates which is then puts us in the situation where we build up bubbles and bust them every, you know, 10, 15 years. So unless we can figure out that, then we need low rates. And that's just a fact, in my opinion. In my opinion, makes no sense. But what's that?
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Good. Hi, Amy.
Good. So what about the real estate market? When is that going to crash? Because, I mean, I there are so many houses that don't even last. You know, my friend sold her house in 10 minutes. They paid cash and $20,000 over the asking price.
Okay, and that's great. So, but remember now, rewind the tape to when we were really building up excess into 2006, 2007. That had been going on for 15 years, where we were scratching our heads, driving out to, you know, to those suburbs that are way even northwest of me that used to be rural, and you'd look and you'd say, who's buying all these houses? And it built up a long, long time. So what I'm saying is, when you're talking about the real estate market, it's always going to go on way longer than you think. And when it corrects, the correction is going to take way longer than you think, because it's not like a stock market where you can press a button and be out of your stock market position. In the real estate market, it takes a long time for these things to unwind. But I think there's still potentially, I don't know if there's much upside in the real estate market, but I'm not concerned. I don't talk to people all the time who said, yeah, I quit my job and now I'm just buying and flipping houses. And I did hear that a lot in 2005 to 2008, and I don't hear it now, and I'm not as concerned about that.
What about Bitcoin and crypto as an asset class, and this against the executive order that Biden issued last week, and dispatching study of Bitcoin in consultation with what Europe is doing on cryptocurrency. Where does that go? How are you viewing cryptocurrency at present?
Okay, so the real, let's say how the enthusiasts, the hodlers, how they view it, they knew this was going to happen the whole time. And frankly, I'm perplexed that it didn't happen 5 or 6 years ago. I don't understand why global governments allowed, they don't like things cutting into their game, and currency and the stewardship of the currency is their game. But they allowed this to happen, I think, for far too long. So the last, again, I'm fine with it. I'm just saying from their point of view. And over the last 3 years, we've seen a ton of institutional adoption of cryptocurrencies. And now the question is it past the point where it can be regulated out of existence? And I think the answer to that is yes. Remember, and Bitcoin was created to be a transfer of wealth outside of the banking system and outside of the central banking system. So it stands to reason that at some point in time that the banking system and the central banking system is going to become a little irritated and try to fight it. They were prepared for this fight is what they will tell you. And it is perfectly capable of living through government regulation. And the proof of that is in countries where governments regulated hard, like China, you know, the price of Bitcoin has gone up, not down.
Well, but there's also, you know, noise that the central bank will produce its own crypto, that perhaps some of the big banks will ultimately produce their own crypto once the regulatory environment stabilizes. What would the impact of these cryptocurrencies at present competing with a crypto backed by the full faith and credit of the United States?
Okay, this is to me is a terrifying discussion when we talk about when the United States says they want to have a digital currency. What they're really saying is, and this has been, you know, other countries around the world, socialist countries have adopted this tact as well. They want to move everybody into the banking system, eliminate currency, and then all of a sudden there's nothing that goes on anywhere that they do not have knowledge of, you know, and it's amazing to me that people want it. And this is all part of, you know, it's going to be a social credit score and a digital ID that shows your vaccine status. These things are all connected. And I don't mean, again, people call us conspiracy theorists, and then everything we say happens to come true about 6 months later. The digital currency thing that central banks and governments are talking about is an awful thing, and it's a boost to cryptocurrency. It's not a competitor to cryptocurrency. It's if cryptocurrency can stay anonymous and stay, you know, underground, then it gives it more, you know, more of a reason to own it.
Well, and so then, and it, to the extent that you're knowledgeable here, I don't want to get, you know, past your comfort level with crypto. But we're always constantly trying to get our handle on this. The underlying blockchain technology is, can you separate crypto from the blockchain technology in terms of the promise of the technology, separate and distinct from its manifestation as a digital currency?
So first of all, there's never something I won't talk about. The fact that I don't know enough about something is never going to stop me from talking authoritatively.
Perfect. Yeah.
But to answer your question, I don't know. I don't, because I always get concerned with how does the anonymity to be protected in the crypto world. And that's basically what you're saying, right? Is like, is the blockchain technology traceable? And are people going to be able to figure out who's paying who what? And again, when I'm saying all these things, I think it sounds like I'm advocating for some sort of criminality, and I'm not at all. I'm advocating for rights to deal with things the way you want to, and not having someone looking at your transactions and discussing if they think they're moral or not. And that's what I'm saying. And to answer your question, I don't know the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. And so that's, we're out of my depth there.
Before we let you go, we started talking about consumer and producer prices and inflation and what the Fed is doing. So, you know, what's your anticipation as it pertains to energy prices and how that translates to the price at the pump with Willie Wilson running around town paying for everybody's gas? He can only do that for so long, Jim.
I thought that was illegal to just pay people to vote for you. He's not running for anything.
Right.
He's not announced yet. I mean, he will later.
He's not announced yet.
But
okay.
He's going to have a gas giveaway in the suburbs, too.
In Chicago, it's illegal to not pay people to vote for you.
It just baffles me. I read these stories. He's paying people to buy gas. It's amazing to me. The inflation, for a year and a half, I was arguing that inflation isn't transitory. Now I'm back to arguing that it is transitory. There's a couple things that are at play here, and let's talk about crude particularly, is that one of the cures for high prices in crude is high prices in crude. It's a demand destruction thing. Part of the use of crude, the consumer use, is inelastic, the part that you're going to work, things like that. But then there's a part of it that's very elastic, the discretionary use of crude. And the question becomes, where, at what level of gas prices does demand destruction start to happen? And I think we're arriving there now. So I think if we get gas prices to the high fours, $5, people will start using less, demand goes down. And right, and at that time, I what's supposed to happen is suppliers are rushing to the scene to drill more. We know what's happening on the federal end here. They're not allowing that to happen, or at least discouraging it through rhetoric. But I do think prices are going to come down now. The flatness of the yield curve is suggesting to me that demand is going to go down, not just in crude, but in a lot of things, and that prices are going to go down. It's going to be under the overarching theme of a recession, which I don't think it's going to be that bad of a recession, but I think that things could right the ship at some point in time in the next year.
He is Jim Urio, analyst for Fox Business and proprietor of Brandt's in Palatine, where they have the best burgers in town. Some pretty good ribs, too, I may add.
I like the tacos. Are you still the tacos on the menu?
Yeah, we still have them. People buy a lot of those fish tacos.
Oh, they're so good.
They're my favorite. Yeah.
Now I'm hungry.
All right, Jim, get back in the kitchen.
See you guys.
Thanks, Jim. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I didn't know the McCaskies were Protestants. See what the Bears did?
What'd they do?
They put out a GIF yesterday for St. Patrick's Day where they, digitally dyed the Chicago River orange.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and said, like, so like that's better, right? Like Bears orange. But it's St. Patrick's Day, Ireland, the orange represents...
Oh, blood in the streets.
Well, it represents the Protestants.
Right.
And it's a Catholic, well, I don't think it's they a Catholic thought that, inspired holiday.
They didn't think that through, Dan.
The ownership is named McCaskey. I mean, come on. They can't even do social media right, the Bears.
They're trying. I mean, they're old. They still live in, you know, their house in Des Plaines. They're just old school.
Well, it'd be closer to the stadium, going to Arlington Heights from there.
That's true. Because it is going to happen, folks. Yeah. Yes.
See ya.
So excited.
Bye, Khalil Mack. Thanks for the one good year.
I heard Virginia McCaskey's not doing well. So
bye, Danny Trevathan.
Keep her in our prayers.
Rebuilding. Bears rebuilding.
Well, she's...
No, I like, well, Virginia McCaskey. Yeah, I know. She's Virginia McCaskey, she's 95 years old or something.
I know, but yeah. She's lived a good life.
She's great.
I'm just saying she's not doing well.
Yeah, well, neither is the Bears marketing department.
Dan. Well, and the big question is, if she goes, will they bring back the Honey Bears?
Yeah. That's,
I think they should bring them back. I think regardless if she, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're all going to. It's okay to contemplate it. I know she's the grand dame, but I mean, we're all going to pass on, so it's not a big deal.
I know.
And
maybe we're all going to die of something.
Maybe
it's not going to be COVID.
At her funeral service, you can make the case to bring back the Honey Bears now.
Have you noticed? Are you watching? Well, obviously, you're watching the March Madness. Why in God's name are the cheerleaders masked up, and the players are not? Even South Dakota State yesterday, I thought, oh, no, they're a free state. They're going to be fine. Their cheerleaders were wearing masks.
Yeah.
It's just so stupid.
I don't know.
But last year they had the tournament. They didn't allow cheerleaders because of COVID. This whole thing is just, I'm so done with it. Coming up on a very special edition of
We used to Northwestern cheerleaders wearing masks, but for a different reason.
Oh.
Yeah. You ugly. You ugly. Your mama says you ugly. Remember that from Wildcats, Goldie Hawn? I love that. I wish we would have cheerleaders. Yeah, cheerleaders. Yes. Cheerleaders should be attacking other cheerleaders, cheering
ugly,
at each
girl,
other. I like
you're
that.
You're ugly.
Yeah. Okay. Your mama says you're ugly.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. The country of Russia has the might to put the U.S. in its place. Still propagandizing on behalf of Putin is Medvedev. No surprise there. And it's no surprise that China is doing the same, although more quietly trying to position itself as a good guy, as we've talked a bit about this week with op-ed in the New York Times suggesting China is an ideal broker for peace and so forth. We'll see how the call between President Biden and President Xi goes today. They're expected to talk. But I don't know where you go when President Xi has declared that Putin is his friend. Their friendship has no limits. And China is at present backing the play of Russia. And why not? Beijing wants Russian natural resources at a discount. And it also gives China the opportunity to pay for to buy as much energy and other resources as Putin is willing to sell, and to use the yuan to do so and advance the notion of the yuan as a global trade currency. So there are definitely some short-term benefits that China has identified. Will they pay long-term costs, particularly if Putin is unsuccessful in conquering Ukraine? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Ian Williams. He's a former foreign correspondent for BBC, Channel 4 News, and NBC. He's the author of Every Breath You Take, New Tyranny. And Ian Williams joins us now. Ian, thanks for joining us. China's New Tyranny, that is. Ian, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Dan. Good morning to you.
Morning. So what do you expect President Xi to offer in his conversation with Biden today?
I suspect there'll be the usual platitudes that China respects sovereignty and territorial integrity, and he'll put himself forward as a peacekeeper. I mean, the problem with that is those claims of respect for integrity don't really bear up to much scrutiny historically with China. And I think as long as Xi cannot even bring himself to mutter the word invasion, as long as he can't call an invasion and continues to echo Putin's justifications, saying that the Russian leader has legitimate security concerns that justify this barbarity, I don't see that he can be a credible intermediary, a credible peacekeeper. And I suspect President Biden will tell him that today, that he needs to come off the fence, that he's tying himself in knots. And if he does not be a little bit more forceful with his good friend Putin, then the long-term damage to China could be enormous, not least getting caught up in secondary sanctions if China does support Russia economically.
But Biden says, you know, you need to come off the fence, I mean, Biden is being more generous than he should be, because we know that President Xi is not on the fence. He's with the Russians. And
that's absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Dan. He has echoed everything that Putin has said, and to portray himself as a peacekeeper is, you know, it is something of a joke. And I think that Biden needs to make that abundantly clear.
Well, what does Putin want from China?
He wants a cushion, an economic cushion. And according to intelligence reports, he also wants other military supplies. That comes as a bit of a surprise, of course, because China traditionally has been a big purchaser of military items from Russia. They in aircraft, tanks, artillery. But they're also, there are more niche items like drones that Russia may be in need of. But fundamentally, it's about economics. It's about cushioning the Russian economy. It was no accident that the very day the invasion was launched, China suddenly decided that Russian wheat was palatable, having banned it because of fears over contamination. They then lifted the ban on the very day the invasion happened. They're pushing ahead with massive energy deals, as you pointed out. The price, no doubt, is pretty good at the moment. And they see it as a way of extending the use of the yuan internationally to part of a longer-term project to break the dominance of the dollar. So China sees benefits there. But I think for Russia, the primary benefit is to help cushion against Western sanctions. But of course, China's got to be careful because its banks are vulnerable, its companies are vulnerable, it's much more integrated in the world economy than Russia is, and it could get caught up in secondary sanctions that Russia, that the Chinese companies could themselves end up being sanctioned as a result of helping Russia. And of course, the Chinese economy is looking pretty wobbly at the moment. Markets have been collapsing. A combination of factors, not least of which is the severe COVID lockdown policies of Xi Jinping.
Yeah, and they've got some pretty aggressive growth targets for this year, too, that don't seem readily achievable. But here's the thing. Do you think that Xi believes that he is too big to sanction because of exactly what you were just describing, China's integration in the world economy and the United States and the West may be willing to pay a higher price at the pump, but if you start to shut down China and all that is imported from China in the West, then you're really starting to negatively impact your consumers, your citizens in the West, and he's betting that the West won't do that.
I think that is his bet, but I think at the same time that he's been shocked by the severity of the sanctions against Russia and the degree of unity among Western companies. He and Putin share this thing, I mean, share a lot of their outlook on history and international affairs. But one thing they do share is this view that the West is in terminal decline, that it's decaying, that their time is up, and that the emergence of this new international order, this axis of Russia and China, is inevitable. And I think they genuinely believe that the response to the invasion of Ukraine would be more muted, that the sanctions would not be as biting and as wide-ranging, and Western democracies would not be unified. And I think that has been a wake-up call for Xi, and there will certainly be those around him who'll be saying, look, hang on a second. I mean, there have already been reports, for instance, that Chinese companies have refused to export aircraft parts to Russia because they're worried about secondary sanctions that they may incur, that Chinese banks have been reluctant to underwrite various deals for the same reason. And I think you are right. The impact of sanctions on China would be far more profound because they're so integrated in the world economy. But at the same time, I think that the resolve that's been shown by the West, the breadth, the bite the severity of the sanctions and the unity has come as quite a shock to China as well as Russia.
So is China's position either get this over with and take Ukraine or come up with some sort of partition deal and get this over with? Is that what they want from Russia?
It's hard to discern what they want at the moment because they seem to be tying themselves in knots. I think it's in we can say without too much doubt that Xi had a broad sense of what Putin had planned, that he was tipped off in that meeting they had before the Olympic Games. The only question is whether he was party to the specifics. Maybe he just preferred not to know. But I think either way, that they were gambling that this would be over with quickly, that Russia's battle-hardened troops would quickly and effectively and ruthlessly roll into Ukraine. Ukraine would fold very quickly. Perhaps they even believed the propaganda that they'd be welcomed on the streets. And I think that this is the worst nightmare at the moment for Beijing. You've got the barbarity on 24-hour news, seemingly open-ended, and anything but decisive. So it's working out in a way that looks very bad, clearly, for Putin, but also by association for Xi.
Is there a scenario, an escalation scenario, in which you think China could be drawn into this as a formal partner of Russia, providing more materials overtly, including potentially troops? And I'm thinking, for example, if there was a NATO slash U.S. enforced no-fly zone, or if that's not far enough, if it would require a bigger trigger, then what if Putin was able to take Ukraine and he did move on to a NATO country?
I think China has traditionally been very cautious. It's always been there for the longer game. It's not been as impetuous as Russia historically. Clearly, that's changed under Xi. He's less patient. He's more confident. He's more assertive. Whether he would throw his lot in with Russia, I'm not sure, because I think whichever way this goes, including if it does escalate to some extent, I see no good outcome for Putin. And I think that as much as China has invested in this relationship, and as important as this partnership is for China, I wonder whether they will recognize that by throwing their lot in with Putin, it's going to undermine a lot of the medium-term and longer-term plans that Xi has for his own role in the world, for his own strategic objectives, not least his ability to snatch Taiwan.
And so, it's sort of one of these things, he may recognize, and was something that Putin may not recognize, that he has not built the capacity to realize his dreams. I'm talking about Putin. So maybe Xi recognizes that. And he wants to help Russia because Russia creates opportunities for him, and it creates antagonism and problems in the West. But he doesn't want to see the Soviet Union recreated because he doesn't want another center of power in Asia. So he wants sort of the Russia that exists maybe to the corporate boundaries of Ukraine and as a problem child for the West. But he still wants China to be the dominant sole superpower in the world, the dominant country in the world. And so it seems to me he would only allow or try to allow Putin and Russia to go so far.
I think that's right. This relationship between China and Russia is in many ways a marriage of convenience. It's opportunistic. It's no less dangerous for it. But their animosities run deep, as you point out, in Central Asia, in the Russian Far East. The Chinese are forever banging on about unequal treaties and historic grievance. And you sometimes overlook the fact that in the 19th century, under a series of treaties, the Russians grabbed huge swathes of the Far East and Central Asia off the dying Qing dynasty. And in Chinese textbooks, the Russians are as big a villains when it comes to unequal treaties as the Brits. So the relationship is a complicated one. Russia is the junior partner, even more so now. And I think that it is useful for Xi to have China upsetting the international equilibrium, as indeed they would have done had this been a more competent operation and swifter operation in Ukraine. But you get close to that point where actually the damage for China is greater than the potential benefits of any messy victory that Putin could eventually claim to have achieved in Ukraine.
And with respect to the West, Will, one of the perhaps the benefits of this, I don't mean to say this is a good thing, but one of the positive outcomes of something that is obviously a negative situation, this invasion, is that Western Europe is reconsidering the approach they've taken to their own defense, to their own energy independence. And you see some movements on those fronts from France and Germany in real time. That seems to me a positive. They're going to make themselves stronger, so they're not in such a compliant position against an aggressor, Putin or somebody else.
I think that's right. This has been an incredible wake-up call, because there was always a tendency, you saw it in France, particularly in Germany, the argument that we need to engage with Russia and indeed with China, the same argument. German companies in particular, and of course other Western companies holding their noses and doing business in Russia, in China, deluding themselves that by doing so, it will make those countries better places and that it will improve relations. But now that dependence has been exposed as an incredible vulnerability over Russia. And I think the wake-up call we're seeing will not be limited to Russia. I think there is an awareness that it's a very dangerous thing to make your economy too dependent on dictators who have grand historic visions of dominating, of rebuilding empire. And that implies equally to China as it does to Russia. And companies have more to lose should there be issues with China than they had even with Russia. But I think that this is a wake-up call, and countries, particularly in Europe, are becoming more aware that there are real dangers inherent in these economic dependencies.
He is Ian Williams, former foreign correspondent for BBC Channel 4 News and NBC, author of Every Breath You Take, China's New Tyranny. Apologies to Sting there. Every Breath You Take, China's New Tyranny is the book. Ian Williams, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Good news. You know, I was just mentioning yesterday how I miss hearing from Tony Science.
Oh, yeah, but he's back.
Tony Science. Oh, Fauci. Right.
Fauci.
Yeah. Man of science, not just the man of science. The man who is science.
He's God.
He was on with Jake Tapper yesterday talking about what we were talking about yesterday with Dr. Marty Makary about Omicron Part 2, the reckoning. This
BA2
new variant, and cases are increasing in some Western European countries as well as China.
And Africa now.
And Tony Science went on with Tapper to say, you know, eternal vigilance, and we have to be prepared to go back to where we were 5 minutes ago in the event I say so.
And the caveat is we need to be flexible. And if, in fact, we do see a turnaround and a resurgence, we have to be able to pivot and go back to any degree of mitigation that is commensurate with what the situation is. So we can't just say we're done. Now we're going to move on. We've got to be able to be flexible because we're dealing with a dynamic situation. Hopefully, the cases will continue to come down as the weather gets warmer. The risk of being indoor is less, and we'll do well, at least for the coming several months. But the one thing that's important, that's a wild card in this, is that there is waning immunity. And we got to make sure that those people who've been vaccinated get boosted.
Of course. Put your mask on and get your shot.
Yeah, shut up. Put your mask on, get the jab.
You know, if only we didn't stop paying attention to him, maybe he wouldn't be punishing us. We need to pay attention to Tony Fauci. We need him on the talk shows, even if he's just repeating the same lines that he's been repeating for the better part of 2 years. Just keep him in the public eye, and then he won't punish us.
Mm-hmm.
Make him stop.
Please.
For more on this. Oh, but by the way, just as an aside, before we get to our guest, I mean, not that this is important to the COVIDians, like those that are in charge of all the big cities in America, like the District of Columbia. New study, and this is the Amazon Post reporting, new study finds the literacy proficiency gap between young white students and students of color in D.C. continued to widen during the second year of the pandemic. Yeah. First of all, the schools are terrible to begin with.
And just exacerbated it.
And then they get worse across the board, but particularly for minority students. 28% of black students, 30% of Hispanics considered proficient in reading in the fall of 2021, as compared to 70% of whites. I'd love to see what the proficiency standard is. I'm not sure I even believe those numbers as bad as they are. That gap between white and black and Hispanic expanded over the last 2 years of largely remote learning. But I mean, hey, Tony Fauci says we got to go back to the previous mitigations. Then that's the end of the conversation. For more on this conversation, pleased to be joined by Batya Unger-Sargun. She's the deputy opinion editor at Newsweek, author of Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Batya, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, we continue to find out as more studies are done that despite what our betters told us, it turns out we actually weren't all in this together.
Oh, man, it is so infuriating. It is so infuriating because, of course, it was so obvious that the racial gap in education was growing and that the most vulnerable, be it black children, black students, be it small businesses, right, be it essential workers, were paying the price for the vanity morals of an elite that wanted to stay home and keep everything locked down. It was so clear at the time that it was happening. And yet, like you say, our betters, the elites, kept pushing this as some sort of moral virtue to hurt the most vulnerable. And they did not stop, and they're still not stopping. And, you know, this is not actually even a blue-red distinction. There's a new study that came out that was quoted actually in the New York Times this morning that found that people who are very liberal, they think that COVID still poses, 47% think COVID still poses a big risk, as opposed to people who are just liberal, who only 22% believe that COVID still poses a big risk. What is very liberal? What's the difference between very liberal and liberal? It's not ideology, it's class, it's income, it's education. These are the people with 2 degrees from fancy universities who make over $150,000 a year. They're in the top 10%. They lord it over all of us. And with COVID, with lockdowns, with Hunter Biden's laptop, they lie to us. They censor what normal, ordinary Americans across the political spectrum know to be true. And then when it comes out that they're wrong, they change the subject.
Yeah, that's how I love it. Right? When the truth comes out, the elites change the subject. But do you think since they've dug in their heels so much that they're actually believing the lie? Because it's hard to convince people that they've been fooled for 2.5 years now.
So again, to me, the most interesting distinction is between the 47%, the very liberal 47%, which, by the way, only represent 10%, 6 to 10% of Americans, right? Those progressives, those very liberals, they are the ones who, you know, overwhelmingly control the media. They are overwhelmingly are represented in politics and in the staffers of our politicians, importantly. They are the ones who are totally dug in.
But liberals, people who are slightly liberal, people who are moderately, and of course people who are conservative, I think these people understand what happened. They understand the lies that we were that they were told, and they're coming out of it. So I'm actually really impressed by the numbers from people who identify as liberal. You know, only 22% of them still believe COVID presents a real risk. And I think that we're starting to see a backlash against these overeducated, affluent elites who have been just lying and lying. I mean, sometimes it's not lies. Sometimes they truly believe their nonsense, you know. But now it comes out, right? Yesterday, the New York Times said, oh, yeah, maybe there's something in this Hunter Biden laptop story. Okay, now what I want is an accounting from you about how you got it so wrong, right? No, that will never happen. Change the subject. Obsess over Ukraine, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, they'd be in real trouble if everybody got together and said, you know, the real problem, it seems to us, is white, rich leftists. And if everybody sort of understood who was running these scams, they actually looked to who's in charge of these institutions that they pay so much attention to and the work product that comes from these institutions that is so influential. Boy, they'd have a real problem on their hands, which is sort of what happened in 2016. And I think that threat there is still very real for them and maybe becoming more real and more urgent with each passing day, as you say, as more people take off their COVIDian masks, both literally and metaphorically.
Yeah, you can really see that the Biden administration has been, when it comes to COVID policy, at least, has been catering very much to that very liberal segment, which represents, you know, like I said, you know, 6 to 10% of Americans. There is very much that sense of leaning into that base, you know, leaning into the donor base, leaning into the people who are funding the Democratic Party, as opposed to the vast majority of people who even vote for Democrats. Of course, you have the same problem on the right. You know, everybody has that. There's that gap between what the voters want and what the donors want. But I think that when you think about like how that gap exists on both sides, whichever side wakes up and says, look, we're not catering to money anymore. We're catering to voters. We're catering to the working class. We realize that there's a wisdom in the working class, right? There's a wisdom in the essential workers who had to brave the pandemic. We're not going to lecture at them. We're going to listen to them. You know, that whoever gets there first is going to have really a lock on a massive, massive constituency. And I think that there's a morality to that, too. We should be listening to the working class. We should be giving them a seat at the table. We should be letting them drive our policy.
And the other thing from the right that we need to be wary of, in my view, do not treat people as mascots. That's just categorical. Don't treat people as mascots.
Yeah.
I'm not here to save you from yourself. I'm here to say we're going to fight this fight and you're a part of it. And you know what? Being a part of it, you have some responsibilities too, because you've fallen for the scams from public sector unions or from these elites and what they tell you about where your kids should be going to school and what they should be learning in quotation marks and all of these other things that you go along with, and you can't go along with it anymore. You've been part of the problem too. It's not just, you know, talking down, I'm coming to save the white working class or to save the working class or to save black kids on the south or west sides of Chicago. Hey, I'm coming with an idea. I'm coming with a perspective. This is a fight that we should fight, but you're joining me as an equal partner, and that means we both have responsibilities.
I love that so much, because I think that one of the main differences between the elites and working class, middle class Americans is the question of autonomy, which is exactly what you're describing, which is the view that, you know, you have both privileges and rights, but also responsibilities to yourself, to your family, to your community, and to your nation. I think that view is very, very foreign to, you know, the very liberal, progressive COVID zero set who believe that the government should take all of the power and all of the control and dictate to us from above, and that journalists should have a lot of power to dictate to us what to believe. And I really love what you're saying about coming to people and saying, look, I have an idea, but you have responsibilities as well to your community, and let's work together to elevate your community and your community's needs and to help everybody get the American dream.
How crazy do you think people are going to become with this new variant, BA2?
I think people are done. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that they're, you know, because I go to these press conferences and people, you know, from WTTW and from the Tribune are like, what, you know, why are we celebrating? Why are we unmasking people in, you know, China? There's millions of people locked down. Well, they have a zero COVID policy, and we don't have that here in Illinois. But I don't know what kind of appetite there's going to be to put masks back on. Do you?
I really think there's going to be very little. I mean, I've, you know, I'll admit here, I've never been a big on that. I've been with the subway without wearing a mask for a long time now, but increasingly I'm seeing my fellow passengers also sort of saying, all right, enough with this, enough with this. And we're in New York, right? So, you know, for the very blue state, you know, blue city at least, I do think that these numbers, especially from this morning, you know, only 22% of liberals and 18% of people who are slightly liberal still believe COVID poses, you know, a risk to their, a big risk to their health. So, you know, those are really, really heartening numbers. And I really hope that we're sort of at the end of this.
What about Ukraine and how we're talking about supporting Ukraine and Steny Hoyer saying we're at war and John Kennedy on the other side, Senator Kennedy, saying that Zelensky is the free leader of the free world. He's the real leader of the free world now. And you know, and then all of this, you know, canceling Russian vodka and Russian mustards and Russian opera singers and so on that have nothing to do with anything except that they happen to be Russian. Do you see a bit of a madness of crowds at play here with the discussion of Ukraine and Russia that we saw at play with COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the difference being that you know that war is at stake when you turn on Fox News and you turn on CNN and there's no difference between them. That was true during the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and it's true now as well, where the journalist set is sort of very much in league with a lot of the, you know, the sort of political elites and the, you know, the foreign policy, you know, think tank blob, right, where they just want war, war, war. And there's a lot of push for escalation. And, you know, it's difficult in this case, as in many cases, because the other side is so evil. I mean, Putin is so terrible. He's a real murderer, a thug. You know, he imprisons the opposition. There's no LGBTQ rights there. There's no freedom of the press. I mean, Russia's hardly a democracy. But at the same time, does that mean that we are at war with Russia? No. I mean, we are not at war with Russia. We represent democracy. We believe in democracy. That is the side we're on. Right now, we are supporting Ukraine's sovereignty because sovereignty is extremely important, one of the most important values. It's the only way you have civil rights, which is what this great nation was founded on. But we are not at war with Russia. For us to be at war with Russia would be to engage in a nuclear war. And I actually think that the administration has shown a lot of strength in standing up to the demand for a no-fly zone, which would essentially be a demand for going to nuclear war with Russia, because you have a Russian leader who has 6,500 nukes, right? That the minute we go to war with them, it's game over. We are not in World War III. Our job is to make sure we do not enter World War III. And I completely agree with you that the same sort of lockstep pressure to agree with everybody dancing in exactly the same tune has taken over, because it is in the elite's interest to go to war, even though I think that it is not even in the Ukrainians' interest for us to engage in this war. Whatever President Zelensky says, however brave he is, you know, it's in his interest to try to get us into that war, and it is very much in our interest and in the interest of Ukrainian civilians who are being shelled to put an end to this war as soon as possible, which means to pay attention to the very successful negotiation efforts that have been happening, but that have been completely blackballed. There's no coverage of it in the media, and I mean no coverage. I mean, here and there you'll get an article about how well negotiations are going, but nobody wants to talk about that when that's really all we should be talking about.
She is Batya Unger-Sargon, deputy opinion editor at Newsweek, author of Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Batya, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Interesting to note that Samuel Huntington, the Clash of Civilizations theorist, you may remember, recently commented that the clash of civilizations between Christian and Muslim hasn't really materialized. He observe the idea that the collapse of the Soviet Union was irreversible and that we're now heading for a Christianity versus Islam confrontation is collapsing. And we can see that it has never played out, never played a role, I should say, in Putin's vision. Since Catherine II, Russia has always integrated Muslims into the empire. And, I mean, we saw that he had Chechenian mercenaries as part of the invading force in Ukraine. And Putin has an imperial vision. He is definitely not having a religion-based geostrategy, as some of the European right believed. And I've heard that, too. And I think I've heard that more ascribed to people on the right than actually people on the right believing that. But there are some. Putin is somehow some great protector of Christians. Not true. It's worth pointing out, among Putin's four military interventions in the former Soviet republics, three have targeted Christian and Orthodox countries. So there you go. There's your I rest my case evidence about Putin as it pertains to Christianity and being any protector of traditional values, or he's conservative, or as you're hearing these unhinged goofs on MSNBC propaganda shows, that Russia is the perfect red state and so on and so forth. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. But there are real Christians doing real work. And one of them, our friend Rod Dreher, wrote about a young woman named Aneta, 25-year-old, who is fleeing Kyiv. And Rod, who's over at AmericanConservative.com, you know, the Benedict Option, and you know Rod's work. He's been on the show enough. He's in Hungary. He meets a woman, her and her husband, who are in America now, but they have a place in Budapest. Their parents escaped communism during the revolution some 65 years ago. And a friend of this Hungarian couple has taken in Aneta, this 25-year-old woman fleeing Kyiv, trying to get to Canada. And not having a penny in her pocket. And he just goes through his interaction with Aneta, and he offers to help. He gives her a little bit of money. He said, I'm setting up a GoFundMe page for you as you make your way to France and hopefully to Canada and start your life over there, which is what's really happening. And what Dreher writes, I think, is worth noting, because it's not the cheap sentimentality that you get from so many political hacks. I mean, it's substantive thinking about these challenges in human terms. He writes, whatever you think about this war and its roots, here we are faced with one of the war's victims, a young woman cast out into the world by the actions of men and by the compassion of a mother and grandmother who see her escape as the focus of their lives now as Russian soldiers encircle her hometown. Yeah, the backstory is mom and grandma told Aneta, you got to go. We got to stay, but you got to go. He continued to Dreher, this is when the abstraction of war became flesh and blood for me. Aneta has fallen into a circle of loving Hungarians who are doing their best to help her, even though they're all afraid of what might be coming next, and even though people in this country are facing skyrocketing prices and an uncertain future. By the grace of God, the Hungarians brought me into Aneta's life tonight, and therefore you as well. And he's going to keep us updated on the progress such that he can maintain updates from Aneta on her journey from Kyiv to hopefully Canada, where she can start anew. For more on this, particularly an interesting piece on the role of the church and faith leaders in Ukraine, pleased to be joined by Jacob Griegel. He's a professor of politics at the Catholic University of America, visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. He has a good column over at firstthings.com, Miracle on the Dnieper, which we will discuss now. Professor Griegel, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
The role of Greek Catholic and Orthodox faith leaders in Ukraine during this moment of an existential fight for the future of that country.
Yeah, and it's a big role, you know. And one of the interesting things about Ukraine is that it has a very complicated church situation, if you wish. It has the so-called Ukrainian Catholic Church, which is essentially Orthodox liturgy, but they accept the Pope of Rome as the successor of Peter and therefore their leader. And also there is a Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is separated from the Russian Orthodox Church. So it's, they're fully Orthodox, but they don't accept the Moscow Patriarch as their head. And then there's a smaller group now, which is the Ukrainian, essentially Ukrainian Russian Orthodox, which responds to the Patriarch of Moscow. All three of these seem to have, including the one that responds to the Patriarch of Moscow, seem to have responded very firmly against the Russian invasion, against the Russian aggression, which is very interesting because otherwise they're fairly divided. They have theological divisions, they have political differences, and nonetheless, when the Russians invaded on February 24th, all of the leaders of these churches have stood by Zelensky and by the Ukrainian defense. In fact, some of them, especially the Ukrainian Catholic, Greek Catholic leader, Archbishop Shevchuk of Kiev, has been incredible. Similar to Zelensky, he essentially gives a little short speech every day in the morning, and he has said quite clearly that Ukrainians have the right to defend themselves, and in fact, have the duty to defend their nation, which is very strong and somewhat unusual for a church leader, especially the ones that we are used to in the West, to be so blunt about this. He's not saying that war is wrong, that war should never be fought. Well, no, I mean, a defensive war is right. A defensive war, in fact, can be a duty of the individuals. He's not celebrating war, right? He's not saying, ah, this is great, we're fighting, we're suffering. No, absolutely not. But he has this at least moral clarity about who is the aggressor and who's the defender. And it's it's a unusual statement from a religious leader, not in history. Right? He had plenty of church leaders that said something similar during war times and World War II and World War I, but unusual in the sense that we're kind of used to church leaders saying almost in a passive tense, right? Wars should not happen or should not be occurring or something like that. Sure, but when you're attacked, I think you have the right to defend yourself.
Yeah, I mean, Pope Julius II, the warrior pope, comes to mind as a notable exception,
exactly.
Too. You know, the warrior pope.
It's been a while, right?
Yes, yes, that has been a while. I agree. But I just want you to develop that a little bit more because I like the phrase that you use here. The role of the church is not to be a global diplomat.
Right.
The role of the church, as you're describing, is to provide moral leadership. And so often in the West, just in this country, and I'll just speak for what I see from the church to which I affiliate, that's the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
You see the complete lack of moral leadership, that it's either sort of neutrality in the face of wrong, or they have folded in with the state and they take the position of the powers that be, regardless, even if it's at odds with catechism.
Right. No, I agree. And here there's some criticism, for instance, especially of the Vatican over the past couple of days, of the Vatican hierarchy and the Vatican diplomacy, which has been somewhat ambivalent because they've been saying, for instance, that both sides should stop fighting.
Yeah. Right.
Well, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But if you're attacked, if somebody enters your house, I don't want to be told that I should be laying down arms. I want to be told that I have the right and the duty to defend my family. And so, and the other side should lay down arms first, by the way, the aggressor, the invader, the thief banging on my door. So in that sense, I think it's just this idea that the church takes a position above the parties, above the the conflict. It's utopian and perhaps overly idealistic. I mean, especially in a case like this, like the war in Ukraine, it's fairly clear who is the aggressor and who is the defender. Right? You don't have to spend too much time to figure that out. So it's not that both sides are morally equivalent in this case. It's not. The Russian side is in the wrong, and the Ukrainian side has the right and the duty to defend themselves. And I think, and there's interesting sort of split here because the local church, the local hierarchy, Bishop Shevchuk and others, have been very clear who has the moral superiority, if you wish, in this conflict, and that's the Ukrainian nation. The Vatican has been a little bit more ambivalent in this, and I think it's somewhat damaging, because that's not the role of the church, as you mentioned. I mean, in the article, I point out that the role of the church is to stand by the parish, the community that they are in, and therefore the nation that is being attacked. And that happened in history, right? It happened in World War II. Probably the most recent example of that is during the Cold War. And you mentioned the Catholic Church. Well, the Catholic Church in Poland in particular, but in other Central European nations too, although the Polish one was probably the most visible and most firm, and the firmest and the strongest one, was that the Catholic Church in Poland stood by the nation in opposition to the Communist Party and the Soviet domination.
And there again, the leadership of John Paul II, you know, leadership matters.
Yes, absolutely. Right. And then when John Paul II or Cardinal Wojtyła became John Paul II, well, he didn't say, well, you know, all parties should be negotiating and should be. No, he goes to Poland and says, do not be afraid, right, to the people. Do not be afraid. I mean, obviously, in terms of the eternal life, but also in terms of your daily life. Do not be afraid, because you are in the right. And I think that firm position had an enormous impact on the level of self-confidence and courage of that nation. And, you know, again, it happened also in the 40s, 50s, 60s. You know, somebody like Cardinal Wyszyński, who was arrested by the communists in the 50s and spent, I can't remember how much time, in prison, under arrest, because he stood by the nation. He decided he will not accept certain things imposed by the communists, including, for instance, the communists wanted to have control over the nomination of bishops. And he said, no, you will not, right? And so there is a certain moment where the church has to make a stand, which is clear. Diplomats usually don't. Diplomats say, well, let's figure out a compromise, right? Let's figure out how we can split the difference. That's their role, right? It's a useful role. It's a necessary role. But I'm not sure that should be the role of the church in cases, especially like this, when it's evident who is the aggressor, who's in the wrong, and who's not.
Well, I know there's no rules in love and war, but when you see Russia bombing schools and churches, what is, you know, the bishops and response to that?
Well, that's right. That's exactly my point. Like the Shevchuk in Ukraine has been abundantly clear about this, right? And a couple of days ago, he mentioned that multiple times about the blood spilled, the innocent blood spilled, meaning, and talks about the churches, the hospital, the maternity hospital bombed by the Russians. Yesterday, they bombed the theater in a city in the southern part of Ukraine. The Vatican has not been as clear, right? Has kept it very, very vague. In a meeting apparently yesterday, 2 days ago, the Vatican hierarchy did use the term war, which is, I guess, an improvement, because the Russians, they had a meeting with the Russian Orthodox Church leadership in Moscow, Patriarch Kirill and others. And the Russian Orthodox hierarchy doesn't use the term war. They use the term that Putin uses, which is, I think, a special military operation, something like that.
Right.
At least in this case, the Vatican said, no, it's a war. So, you know, there's at least some differences. But
well, I like
again,
I like Shevchuk, as you mentioned, it is our natural right and sacred duty to defend our land. So natural right, sacred duty, those are things that we're not going to compromise. Those are things that are not on the table. And again, moral clarity like that has been in short supply from the church recently.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, he continued in that speech, which was one of the first speeches he gave. He said even stronger. He said something like, our soul and our body, we offer for our freedom, right? I mean, that's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are limits, and there's a willingness to sacrifice ourselves. That is, well, both a right and a duty to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of these the leaders, is to actually see the value of community, the value of a nation, and the importance of protecting it. You know, there are differences, like in all nations, there are differences. The Ukrainians have plenty of differences, political, ideological, including religious.
Mm-hmm.
But the role of these leaders was, including the political leadership, Zelensky, was to say, well, yes, we have differences, but right now we have a much higher priority, which is that these guys are coming and bombing our towns, our hospitals, our churches. We got to defeat them. And you know, these differences have very quickly disappeared, or have disappeared. It's too strong of a term. They'll come back when the war is over. But they have been put aside because there's a higher priority to protect this community, this nation of the Ukrainians.
Yeah, it's a unified commitment to not live on their knees. And
exactly,
it's something to witness. It's encouraging, inspiring. Mm-hmm. Jacob Griegel, professor of politics at the Catholic University of America, visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. Professor Griegel, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Dan and Amy, that time of the week, Open Mic Friday, as you heard, per the theme music.
By Justin Kosick.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line, taking your calls with comments, compliments, critiques, crack pottery, we'll take it all. Amy, would you like to offer anything before we get to the callers?
You know what? It's like an angry Friday for me. I'm very upset. I'm upset that my kids, who are now can be free, and mom here and others fought for their freedoms for 2 years to not be masked. Well, to get them back in school, to get them playing sports, and to get them unmasked. And they're not doing it because of peer pressure. And I'm very disappointed. I think that you need to call Payne and Eli at once and set them straight, Uncle Dan.
I'd be happy to do that. Yeah.
I mean, they're hanging it on their chin. I said, well, then just take it off.
Have you tried the, if everybody ran off a cliff, would you run off a cliff?
Yeah, I said, well, this is a chance. I said, well, are you scared of COVID? No. All right. And you've been vaccinated, whatever, you know, you've been compliant, you're a healthy kid. Why don't you be a leader? Because Peyton or Eli, people, you know, he's very popular. If you take off your mask.
Of course.
Well,
of course.
I've seen possible homecoming king, maybe homecoming king. Yeah. You know, maybe next year. Maybe. Uh-huh. If he plays his cards right. But like if you take it off, then other people will follow.
Maybe they've got it right and it has nothing to do with COVID. This study published in the Cognitive Research Principles and Implications Journal.
Oh, can I put that copy back on my desk?
I will do
you
that.
You little sneak. I know what you're doing.
Blue medical masks were associated with being the most attractive, and cloth masks were second, still making faces significantly more attractive, according to researchers at Cardiff University's School of Psychology in the UK, which published this study in the Cognitive Research Principles and Implications Journal I borrowed from you. Our study suggests faces are considered most attractive when covered by medical face masks, told co-author Michael B. Lewis. He told The Guardian. So maybe that's it. They just know that it makes them look better to have the mask on. And frankly, there are a lot of people who do look better with the mask on.
Isn't it weird? Because I saw some other journalists finally take their masks off and I gasped. I wasn't expecting to see
the summer teeth.
Yeah, some are here, some are there. Or just the shape of the chin.
Yeah.
It's very strange. But a lot of kids have told me that they are not taking off their mask because they don't like their face or they don't think that they're attractive enough. And I'm like, oh, you're beautiful inside and out.
Which is confirmation that they're not attractive, especially when you say in that sing-songy way. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to be helpful, you know?
And you've got a great personality.
Yeah.
Forget about that. Yeah. Okay, but that's it. That's science right there. Science says you're more attractive with a mask or some people
are. I
just don't
know, while playing sports, how effective masks are when they're soaking wet with sweat.
The whole thing's ridiculous.
Okay, let's move on.
Paula,
do you have anything you want to get off your chest there?
No.
Nothing? Nada?
No, I'm just easing out of the week here. Okay. Paula and Racine, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. So I was listening to your professor guest, and I don't know that I got his whole segment, but basically it sounds like he failed to mention how the Ukrainian Orthodox Church actually has a role in instigating the conflict. There was just one historic Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and it funneled up to the Russian Orthodox Church since its founding more than 1,000 years ago. But of course, about 3 years ago, the same Western elites who backed the 2014 political coup backed a schism within that Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and they backed a breakaway sect to remove Russia's authority over the Orthodox Church in the Ukraine. You know, that had been the law of the land for 1,000 years, but of course, our Western elites know better. They're playing the game of risk. Obviously, Putin is wrong with his actions, but there's very little discussion on how we got here, including the schism in the Orthodox Church, who prompted it, these global elites who are just sitting around playing their game of risk, and the people of Ukraine and even the people of Russia are suffering. It's unfortunate.
Thanks for the call, Paula. Well, he did note, Professor Griegel from Catholic University, that you have faith leaders from different churches and different traditions that are all coming together, at least some of them, to say the same things to those Ukrainians that are fighting to repel the Russian invaders. But we have talked about the run-up to this, both in terms of U.S. policy, also in terms of what Ukrainian governance has looked like over the last 30 years, whether it be pro-West regimes or pro-Russian regimes, and how it's been a playground for the oligarchs. And I'm not just talking about Hunter Biden. Rick in Downers Grove.
Dan, I'm from the listening audience, and I'm here to help.
Thank
you. Earlier this week, you said you received a steak from some outing and needed somebody to grill it.
Yeah.
I can solve your problem with three words: George Foreman Grill. You get one of those, and your grilling problems are solved.
Is that right? Yeah. All right.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for the call, Rick. They've been around
for
a while.
I like the smoker better.
I like that egg thing. The egg thing. The egg thing is supposed to be the best grill out there. I don't grill. I don't cook anything and never have, never will. But the egg is what I understand is the best grill.
Oh,
now.
That egg.
Better than the Foreman grill. It's like the big green egg. That's what I understand. I don't know. I rely on experts in the field. Beth.
Wait, where is that steak, by the way? Can we give it a little something?
It's,
I gave you a burrito.
It's not in my pocket.
Well,
you know,
where is it?
Yeah, we'll get it to you so that somebody can cook it up.
Yeah, you
fry it
want
up in a pan.
Pan. We'll smoke it. Well, we'll brine it first. We got a hole, and then the sous vide, we'll use the whole thing. Andrew's got a plan. Peyton.
I'll bring home the steak. You'll fry it up in a pan. And
never let you forget who's the man.
Yeah, exactly.
My name's Tim, and I'm transitioning.
Beth and Joliet.
Hi. There's a book by Archbishop Vigano.
Yes.
V-I-G-A-N-O. All about the church and the state. All in this together. It's the marriage between the deep church and the deep state. And it lays it out perfectly.
Well, all in what together?
All in the globalization of the church.
Well.
Of the world through Vatican II. It's very interesting. It's very enlightening.
All right. Thanks for the call, Beth. Rich, Indian Head Park.
Yes, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. What I'd like to know is, when is Jesse Smollett going to be held responsible for what he's doing in the courts? He's making a mockery of the courts. When are they going to say enough is enough?
After his appeal.
And put him back into...
After the appeal. Thanks for the call, Rich. After the appeal to overturn his conviction based on double jeopardy, which is an argument they made before trial, admittedly to another judge, that was rejected and he was convicted. The whole double jeopardy argument is not exciting. It's not a new argument. It's not a particularly compelling argument they have for double jeopardy. He's going to go to prison unless
Governor Jelly Pritzker Belly commutes his sentence, and I'm going to ask him that today if they let us into the press conference.
Yeah.
Which they better.
Bob, Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Lots to discuss this week, but I was hoping you would have spent more time discussing Hunter's laptop this morning.
Yeah, Dan.
Biden lied.
You mentioned it, though.
What is there to discuss? We discussed it when it actually happened, and now the New York Times is just reciting something the New York Post wrote about a year ago, and we're supposed to say, oh, wow, the New York Times. Oh, yeah, we discussed it in detail. Okay, now the New York Times is cutting and pasting articles from the Post. Okay. What else is there to discuss?
Well, now we know that Biden lied to us.
Well,
and the media is covering it up. And are they going to really finally report on this thing?
Oh gosh, Bob, come on. I mean, Bob, the triumph of hope over experience. Are they going to really report on this thing?
Bob,
come on.
You know better.
Well, have a good weekend. I'm waiting to see what happens.
All right, thanks, Bob.
I love Bob.
I do too.
Not as much as I do. He's my Swedish engineer buddy.
This much.
Oh, I know.
Leonard, Highland Park.
Yeah, I heard a rumor that if Virginia McCaskey passes, Sister Jean is ready to take over. And
well, we're going to bring back the Honey Bears.
I don't think Sister Jean. The caddy from Highland Park, we had a great conversation about golf a couple years ago. But when it comes down to football, baseball, professional basketball, if they all stop playing, I could care less. And I used to be a season ticket holder on both sides of town for the Sox and Cubs. I can't watch it anymore.
I got to tell you, I'm right behind you, actually. It's sad to say, but I am.
Horse racing, golf, and hockey, that's all I can watch now. But I'm still caddying, 65 years old, ready to go.
Good for you. Where are you looping this summer?
I'm going to be at Briarwood this summer.
I'll get to Briarwood. We'll catch up. Thanks for the call, Leonard.
Oh, you big shot. I'll get there.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
I know people at Briarwood. I can get on Briarwood.
Yeah.
Elliot Wilmette.
Hey, how you doing? It's I wanted to thank Dan for coming over to New Tier Neighbors on Tuesday, and we had a terrific, enjoyed him bringing along Josh Mitchell to discuss his book, American Awakening. It was quite a lovely evening.
Thank you, Elliot. It was good to see you. Catch up. Elliot's got a new job. It's all good. And it was a great evening, great talk by Josh Mitchell. It's a great book, America Awakening. And, some intellectual activity up in Neutra Township. Who would have thunk? Jennifer, Glen Ellen.
Oh, hey, I was just calling to talk to you about the science of masking. And I go on a lot of websites like Reddit, where there's a lot of younger people on there to try to get them correct information. And there was an article or a link recently on PFAS and toxic chemicals. And, you know, people were talking about it, and I said, hey, did you know that a lot of the surgical masks that you all are wearing are loaded with this stuff? And they refused to believe me, and they would put down responses like source, you know, and I provided some articles, and then they're like, oh, this must be from Fox News, or this source is not a credible scientific publication. So I finally put one up there from the NIH. And then they finally would admit, oh, well, here's a correct source. And it's just laughable because they honestly, if CNN doesn't tell them something, they will not believe that there's any factual information about this out there. And these masks were designed for surgeons to not get blood splatter and bodily fluids in their mouth. So, of course, there's a lot of chemicals on the mask to prevent that. And they were never designed for kids, and not even adults, to wear 8 hours a day. And it's just really sad that you can't even talk to young people about this without them automatically assuming that it's fake news.
Thanks for the call, Jennifer. John in Mundelein.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate unequivocal condemnation of Putin. I appreciate the president calling Putin a war criminal. Unfortunately, part of the problem you guys in right-wing media have is that there are legions of people in your audience who are out there saying, well, you know, Putin is just worried about his borders, or he's fighting Nazis, or the biolab stuff, and they hear Trump saying that he's a genius. Why is it that so many people in your audience aren't willing to share your unequivocal condemnation of Putin?
Yeah, thanks for the call, John. It's a mischaracterization of what is being said. It is a mischaracterization of where I think our audience is and where conservatives are. They're not flacking for some KGB communist thug and war criminal like Putin. That's not happening. Just as I mentioned, this idea that people are running around in any significant numbers. There's, you know, 330 million people. There's a lot of people with a lot of conspiracy theories and ideas about the world that turn out not to be true. But I'm saying in terms of center of gravity, where thoughtful conservatives are, which is most conservatives, That is not where they are, where you characterize it. They're not running around saying Putin is protecting Christianity. They're not running around with any of these conspiracy theories. They're not promoting denazification as some sort of rationale for Putin's invasion. That's just not true. And you can by the way, you can also disagree with somebody in terms of their understanding of what's happening or their belief in what Putin is intending on doing without getting into all of this treasonous, traitorous Manchurian candidate hysteria, which the left stock and trade, like your buddies, John from Underline on MSNBC, who we play it on the show, who refer to, you know, Russia is the ultimate red state, like Russia and Florida or Texas are the same. And we have the same sort of perspective on things, even as the left will then rush to defend the Russian people as also protesting Putin and not on board for this war. But residents of Texas and Florida, well, they're on board for the, you know, rapacious revanchism of Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott. The left is hysterical. You are completely unbounded by anything resembling the integrity to disagree on the merits. And so you conspiracy theorize those who you criticize for being conspiracy theorists, because that's what you do. You project who you are, anti-intellectual, disingenuous, hateful people. You project those qualities onto the people with whom you disagree, the people who don't share the qualities that you demonstrate. So that's what's happening. John, thanks for the call. Bob in Edison Park.
Yeah, you know what? Maybe I'm one of those people John was just talking about, because I have a little more I won't say pro Russia, but I'm a little more leaning toward sympathy for Russia than even you, Dan. And here's what I'll say.
Well, even me, I have no sympathy for Putin. Zero.
Okay. All right. Well, okay, fine. But here's the issue. No matter what side you fall on this, and these neocons at Fox News.
Yeah, you're missing the point.
Else.
You're missing the point.
Okay. Could I get to my point?
Well, then make it. Don't give me the neocon.
Okay.
Just make your point.
Okay.
What's your position?
My point is this. Putin had as much right going into Ukraine as we did going into Iraq. That's a fact.
No. Okay, Bob. Saying it like that doesn't make it so. And it's not so. And, you know, the argument, like offered, you know, here we go. Yeah. Tucker Carlson is sort of even though I disagree with him, is sort of not at the same intellectual level, but are making the same argument that Professor Mearsheimer at University of Chicago has made about NATO's expansion west provoking Putin. Mearsheimer, by the way, is a socialist. And so, you know, this idea that this is so evenly split in terms of people's understanding of what happened and what we should do in response to the invasion, it's not so neat as these partisan hacks, the Never Trumpers and the socialists, and the I'm for whatever's popular at present crowd would have you believe, number one. Number two, you can disagree with an assessment the way that, say, Princeton history professor Stephen Kotkin disagrees with Mearsheimer, University of Chicago, without suggesting that anybody is, again, a flack for Putin, is engaged in some sort of subversion of democracy or the West or some such thing like this. And it's the same thing with criticism of American policy and the appeasement forays into foreign countries, the quixotic state building exercises. You can disagree with all those policies and rightly point out their failures without then suggesting that, you know, somehow Putin is a sympathetic figure. You can understand what he's doing or what he has done in Ukraine is the same thing that we did with respect to Iraq or Afghanistan. That's ridiculous. So Bob in Edison Park, that is a ridiculous position. It is not only not a fact, it's an untruth. And as I said, there are some people that have these perspectives. It doesn't mean he's treasonous. It doesn't mean that he's a flack for Putin. It means he, in my estimation, he's got it wrong. But that doesn't justify the smears of a John from Underline and the MSNBC crowd that you see ubiquitously on a daily basis ever since this started. Tom, Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan, Amy. Female swimmers cannot expect to be defended if they're unwilling to defend themselves directly, not through parents or third parties. And it is, Dan, I could sense this morning there's just a bit of enjoyment in watching this go on with Leah Thomas. And I wanted to ask you if you thought it was possible that Buckets Allen was the love child of Leah Thomas and Lori Lightfoot.
Okay, Chuck and Delavan, let's close it out on a high note.
That's a fact, Jack. Hey, what's the matter with that guy? I want to thank the lady who called in earlier with the mask. She named my band from high school Blood Splatter and Bodily Fluids. Hey, I was in downtown. I was in downtown Lake Geneva yesterday at Magpies. I hope you squeezed me in. I did my audition for your yell at Dan Prof night.
Yeah, let's
It was like about 30 people there, and they were completely hysterically laughing. It was really good.
So you think you should be a roaster? You should think you should be a roaster?
Everybody thinks they should be a roaster.
All right. Well,
I don't have to be a roaster. I can just sit.
You're going to be a heckler. You can be a heckler, but here's the thing, Chuck. Do Amy a solid. Help her with her routine. Help her with her segment.
It's a work in progress.
Yeah. So email Amy offline and give her some guidance, will you, Chuck?
Okay. No problem. You guys have a great weekend. Everybody do that.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.